KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Matt Holzman, filling in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business. For the past 20 years, Elise Perlstein has dedicated her life to documentaries, first as an award-winning producer, and since 2013 as the Senior Vice President of Documentary at socially-minded production company Participant Media. But her career in docs wasn't always a foregone conclusion.
When I go through old notebooks from notes from films, I kept finding lists of other jobs I can do. I'd never felt like documentary filmmaking was a sustainable, viable long-term career path, and I think that's really changed.
As documentaries are having a moment, Elise Perlstein gives us her view from the middle of it all. She tells us what Participant is looking for in new projects and how she views the big streamers now that they've become both powerful distribution partners and production competitors. She also tells us about some upcoming Participant releases, including American Factory, a verite film that follows employees of a former GM plant in Ohio after it's taken over by a Chinese billionaire. But first, the banter. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW.
I'm Matt Bellany, filling in for Kim Masters this week, and I'm joined by Lucas Shaw, who is an entertainment reporter for Bloomberg News. Hi, Lucas.
Hey, Matt. Great to be here.
Okay, so let's start with Disney. I've heard a ton of people refer to this as D-Day, Disney Plus Day, when Disney is finally revealing the scripted and unscripted offerings that are going to power its streaming direct-to-consumer service, aka the Netflix killer, that's going to launch later this year. And, you know, some people believe Disney is too late to the party. Netflix already has 138 million people who are subscribing to its service. I actually think the opposite. I think Disney is absolutely well positioned to be a player in the streaming space. It has a content library unlike any other company out there, and it has the assets to produce content for decades to come. So if anyone is going to succeed in streaming, I think it's going to be Disney long term.
Yeah, I mean, after years of pretending that Netflix was not a threat to their business, you see all these media companies jumping over one another now to try to replicate its success, whether it's AT&T or Apple, CBS, Comcast. And of all those, I think that Disney is the best position because of that library that you note. It's going to be Star Wars series, Marvel series, Pixar series. So if you're a parent, if you're a fanboy, if you love movies, you're going to have to pay for Disney Plus if you want to watch those. There are some doubts about Disney's kind of commitment and approach. You know, Netflix loses a lot of money still, despite those 139 million customers. So is Disney, which is used to reporting huge profits every quarter, going to be comfortable losing money on services for years to come? But of the services trying to start something new, I think Disney's in the best shape.
Yeah, I actually talked to Bob Iger about that issue a year ago when they were first putting together plans for this service. And I asked him, I said, you know, are you and the shareholders, more importantly, prepared to, first of all, sacrifice the hundreds of millions of dollars that you have been getting from Netflix and other streamers to license your content and to invest in the kind of way it's going to take to be competitive here? And he says, you know, the shareholders are on board. They understand this is the future. Disney is a company that throws off a lot of profit, unlike Netflix, as you mentioned, and they can invest in this area. And he's really sold the shareholders on this vision. And I can tell you, as the parent of a three-year-old boy, when the Cars movie goes off of Netflix, there's going to be hell to pay. And I'm going to have to find where the Cars movie is. And I guarantee you the Cars movie is going to be on Disney Plus, and I will pay them whatever it takes to get that movie back on my kid's screen.
Yeah, and you know, the other question I have, and I don't know if you talked about this with Iger, is an internal one. Because all of the streaming businesses that Disney has, that Disney Plus and ESPN Plus and Hulu, which they now own a majority stake in, they report up to this one executive, Kevin Mayer, who's worked for Bob Iger for a very long time, is one of his chief lieutenants. But the studios, the TV studios that are going to make all the shows that are going to help sell these services are under Peter Rice, who just joined Disney from Fox. You know, are those two executives going to be aligned, or are they going to be jumping over one another to compete to be the successor to Bob Iger? Because Bob Iger continues to hang around at Disney. He's been CEO for a very long time. Lots of speculation over who would replace him. And it now seems like Kevin Mayer and Peter Rice have positioned themselves to be the next in line.
I mean, that's the management challenge, right? I mean, if you're Bob Iger, it's been very clearly communicated to your lieutenants that this is the priority, that winning the streaming war is the next priority for the Walt Disney Company. So however those two executives can best position the company for success in that arena, I think gives them a lot of cachet when that time for succession comes. The issue that I wonder is, how are they going to define these brands? I mean, what is a Hulu show going to be versus a Disney Plus show versus, you know, an FX streaming show that they now own versus all these other different platforms? Because it seems that Disney Plus is going to be much more of a family-oriented play, whereas Hulu is going to be a little bit more of an adult-oriented play. But I just don't know how that's going to be specifically articulated to the consumer.
They have not articulated it, as far as I can tell, to the people selling them shows. I mean, one of Netflix's great strengths is the simplicity, is you just go there for all TV shows, all movies. Yes, Netflix now makes stand-ups and documentaries and every type of programming out there, but it is a unified brand that people now associate with TV. If you get home at the end of the day and you just want to watch something, you're going to open up Netflix because you know there will be something for you to watch. Can a company like Disney kind of split Netflix into two or three different pieces and have the same kind of success? You know, there's a difference between signing up 20 million subscribers and signing up 100 million subscribers.
Yeah, and now that you mentioned Netflix, let's just pivot a little bit there. I mean, Netflix is sitting by watching very closely what Disney is going to do, because as we've noted on this show before, the majority of viewing on Netflix is currently shows that Netflix does not own. So they are furiously putting stuff into production to try to build up their library, because they know that Disney and Warner Brothers and all these other companies are pulling their content eventually from Netflix. And part of that is the awards game. Netflix is desperately in the awards game, trying to get Oscars and Emmys and any other kind of award to distinguish their content in a sea of competitors. So they did some interesting things this past week. As you reported, they're launching a magazine. I don't know if I should be nervous or not. Netflix Magazine is going to promote their shows and their content. And then they also are in talks to buy the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. And that seems like a play to showcase their movies and TV shows to the talent community, to say, hey, you can premiere your movies at a big Hollywood premiere, even if they're on Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain irony in Netflix, which is the company that brought TV and movies to the internet, buying a brick and mortar movie theater, or at least in talks, and publishing a print magazine. But it all fits into its larger transformation from a tech company to an entertainment company. And Netflix is a company that likes to do everything in-house. That includes very boring but important things like managing the communications on its set. And so I think it wants to control how it promotes its shows and its movies in every way. So it bought billboards so it can always have them available for its shows. It buys a theater so it can always use them for events, for premieres, for screenings. And now it publishes a magazine so it can always make sure it stars on the cover. When you're putting together a new issue with the Hollywood Reporter that's, you know, ahead of Emmys, there's a chance that there'll be a Netflix person on the cover. But this year, I would guess that there might be somebody from Game of Thrones or Handmaid's Tale or from another network. You know, this magazine isn't going to be on newsstands. It's not for sale. It's a little bit like how movie studios buy billboards of their movies outside of their lots. Netflix wants to communicate to executives, to talent, that people care about these shows and that they are the most important thing in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key point, I think. The biggest problem that the talent community has with Netflix, it seems, it's not the money, they get paid a lot, it's the impact your show is going to have. People are very afraid that their show or movie is just going to get dumped on the service. They call it direct to Netflix, which is kind of a dig because it's like direct to video, and you're not going to get the cachet and the cultural win that you get if you release a movie and it's a hit in theaters, or if you have a show on, you know, HBO that plays once a week for 2 months and people are talking about it sequentially like that. So they're trying to appease talent by saying, look, you're on the cover of Netflix magazine. I don't know how much that's going to work. I think that people are pretty savvy and they see a transparent PR play, and it's not going to mean anything to be on the cover of Netflix magazine, in my opinion. But it does show how concerned Netflix is about their reputation among talent.
Yeah, I mean, Netflix says that this is a test, but it does feel that the executives at that company are very conscious of this one criticism. And as a user of the service, it seems obvious that they're putting out so much every week. You know, they release Our Planet, the new nature documentary. I've watched a couple of episodes. I'd like to finish it before I can get around to finishing it. They're going to have released 3 or 4 new projects this weekend. How do I keep up with all that? And if you're a director or an actor or a writer and you're from one of the shows that's not getting all that attention, you feel neglect. And that engenders some anger towards Netflix. I think executives at Netflix are very conscious of a backlash coming. They've come in, they've thrown money around, and they've made people very happy by giving them creative freedom and winning awards, but they know that at some point there's going to be some blowback.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Thank you, Lucas.
Thanks, Matt.
That is Lucas Shaw, entertainment reporter for Bloomberg News.
The 2008 documentary Food, Inc. might have changed the way you eat after hearing from people like Carol Morrison, a chicken grower for agri-giant Purdue.
A lot of these chickens here, they can take a few steps and then they plop down. It's because they can't keep up with all the weight that they're carrying.
Elise Perlstein co-wrote and produced Food, Inc., which won 2 Emmys and was nominated for Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. It lost out to The Cove, but Participant Media won big that night at the Academy Awards since it produced both films. Participant aims to make both fiction and nonfiction films that have a social impact. Other documentaries they've produced include An Inconvenient Truth, the Edward Snowden doc Citizen 4, and RBG, which they co-produced with CNN and which was nominated for an Oscar this year. As for Elise Perlstein, she produced 3 more documentaries for Participant after Food, Inc. Then, in 2013, Participant hired her to become their senior vice president of documentary film and television. Documentaries are making money, and they're making headlines. And as documentary film is having a moment like it's never seen before, we sat down with Perlstein to talk about the transformation in the industry. Do you have a strategy for what films you decide to produce?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, within the specific mandate that is Participant, there are lots of factors that determine what's going to make a good documentary. I mean, for us, we're not doing breaking news, and we're not necessarily looking to tell all sides of a story. We're looking for stories that are richer because of the hindsight, because a little time has passed and you have more insight into why certain things happened. And we're also looking for filmmakers with a point of view.
But you're talking about a point of view about the story. Are you talking about also a creative point of view?
Creative point of view about the story. Not necessarily, you know, a political agenda or a activist agenda, but a point of view in the sense that they know why they're telling the story.
That seems like something that should be a requirement for any film ever.
It should be.
but there are movies that you wonder exactly.
Well, and I think sometimes that question about where journalism and documentary overlap kind of comes to play with this point of view question, because documentaries can be journalistic and not say, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, those are not mutually exclusive, but that perception is there sometimes.
Well, you've been around the documentary world long enough to see it change rather dramatically, especially with huge amounts of money coming in from the streaming companies, which are turning into studios as well as distributors. One of the effects of that is we're seeing documentaries become, for lack of a better word, mainstream. I mean, one of the things that's interesting to me about Netflix is that when you open it and you see movies suggested for you, you might see fiction films and nonfiction films right next to each other. So they're kind of creeping into our consciousness as like a movie.
It's subversive
a movie.
Documentaries.
I know. It's taken a while. But can you talk about some of the ways that the business has changed since you've been in it?
I mean, I think that the business has definitely become more respected as a creative filmmaking
Documentaries are becoming more cinematic.
Documentaries are becoming more cinematic. I think there's more emphasis from the filmmakers on really using the tropes of storytelling to great effect without having to go into untruth.
Right.
And I was thinking about this. In some ways, the money, more robust budgets allow for you to kind of work with the best people in all the different craft positions. So cinematographers, composers, editors, post-production, all of the kind of technical aspects of the filmmaking can be elevated when you actually have a budget. But the other parts of filmmaking that make documentaries more accessible and I think enjoyable now don't really cost money. It's about storytelling. It's right. about casting, quote unquote, you know, finding the right characters who are going to tell your story, knowing when to find people. You know, if they've already gone through their most dramatic thing, you may not want to film with them. You want to film with somebody who's experiencing something as you're filming. And I used to work with somebody who said, you want what the person is going through to be more important than the fact that you're filming them. If the fact that you're filming them is the biggest thing in their day, they're probably not going to make the best character. You want people at times of change and facing dramatic dilemmas and decisions. That makes good drama.
I think one of the interesting downsides, it's kind of a strong word, of documentaries becoming more popular entertainment is, I mean, for instance, the true crime genre is obviously very, very popular. But that starts to get further and further away from the mission of what both documentaries in general and Participate in particular have been trying to do, which is to make a difference with these films. The other thing that seems to be problematic is that, you know, I feel like documentaries should be exposing a lot of light to a subject, not heat. And in order to gain audiences and in order for the press to talk about it, these films have to be a little sensational. And so that also kind of moves you away from the core mission of wanting to make a difference in the world. You're debating if you agree.
Well, I think the true crime genre has proven to be successful, but I don't think that's the only way to bring heat and light and drama to a subject. And, you know, just to kind of mention one of our own films, American Factory, which just premiered at Sundance and won the Director's Award. That's an incredibly rich, juicy, funny, interesting film that's not sensationalizing anything. It's just the subject matter itself is so inherently dramatic, and the access the filmmakers had to the story gives you an insight into what's happening. So I think that there's a different way to kind of get that excitement and interest that's not just from kind of sensationalizing.
Well, so American Factory, I saw it at Sundance. There are points that are literally jaw-dropping, like you can't believe what you're seeing on the screen. The problem really is, though, how do you get people to see a movie like that? Because, I mean, look, American Factory, you know what I mean? It sounds very like, oh, it's an American Factory. But people don't know what, not only an incredible film in terms of its filmmaking and all its surprises, but the fact that, you know, for a lot of working people, it's going to feel incredibly relevant. You know what I mean? It could be a hard sell.
Well, it's a film that benefits also. Sometimes we get lucky and our films get born into a world that's ready for them
right.
in terms of the zeitgeist. So when we started this film a few years ago, we had no idea that the China tariff trade conversations
right.
would be in the headlines every day. So I think this film is actually incredibly well poised to hit a zeitgeist that's going to expand the audience.
Well, with documentaries generally, zeitgeist and marketing are so important. I mean, you look at RBG and you look at Won't You Be My Neighbor, and those movies couldn't have been timed better,
right.
like if they had planned it. So one of the things that has happened in the modern age of documentary is people are funding movies that they already know what the movie's going to be. It's a pretty hard sell to a production company to say, gee, I don't know if I'll have a story here or not. Give me $5 million to make it. And I wonder if an American Factory is one of those films that, I mean, nothing could have happened. It could have all gone great, and then you wouldn't really have much of a movie. And I wonder how you justify making movies that you really don't know what you're going to get when you put some money up on the table.
I don't think you ever know what you're going to get with documentaries. I think there's always an element of unpredictability and discovery in documentary filmmaking, and the best filmmakers and the best financiers of documentaries allow that evolution to happen. You have to change and follow the story. So they're just different degrees. We like to develop documentaries to a probably higher level than some other financiers might do, which just means supporting filmmakers to do the research, really dive into the kind of access they're going to have. Mm. But you can't control the variables of a documentary. You have to have a sense that the filmmaking journey is going to be interesting in and of itself, even if you don't find, you know, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. I'm sometimes wary of films where you don't know if you're going to find the elusive creature in the wild, but, you know, the filmmaker will say, but it's going to be incredible anyway. Sometimes that's true. Sometimes you really need to find the elusive creature.
Coming up after a short break, Elise Perlstein tells us about courting multiple offers at Sundance for the film American Factory. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman, filling in for Kim Masters. We're talking to Elise Perlstein, Senior Vice President of Documentary for Participant Media, and a former nonfiction filmmaker herself. Because Participant produces and finances movies, but it doesn't release them, Perlstein finds herself working with distributors across the industry. This year alone, Participant has documentaries airing in theaters with Sony Pictures Classics, on television with HBO, and streaming on Netflix. The film going to Netflix is called American Factory. It premiered this year at Sundance, and it follows what happens when a Chinese auto glass company, Fuyao, buys a shuttered former GM plant in Dayton, Ohio. At first, it seems like everything's getting a facelift, including the factory's street address.
Please join me in acknowledging the newly named Fuyao Avenue.
Just before the factory opens under new management, a Fuyao vice president holds an upbeat press conference.
Give people jobs and give a future to your kids and my kids that did for those trucks back there when our parents and grandparents worked on refrigerators and cars. And the future is bright, folks. The future is bright.
Spoiler alert, the future turns out to be complicated. When Perlstein first started working at Participant in 2013, streaming companies like Netflix were just dipping its toe into creating its own content. Now, of course, it's a very different story. Who are the streamers to you? I mean, in a way, they're a distribution partner, and in a way, they're a competitor because they're producing so many documentaries.
Right. I think that's the pendulum that we're all watching. There's a swing back and forth between the streamers acquiring finished films and then kind of stepping back, closing their wallets, and just financing the creation of their own content. And just in the last couple of years, we've seen that change. If you look at Sundance, this last Sundance, the streamers were spending money again on both documentary and narrative film acquisitions. And there's just increasing competition. You have Apple streaming coming online, Disney Plus, Hulu is becoming more robust. Amazon is back in the game. There's a lot of competition. So
that's a good thing for documentaries.
It's a good thing for documentaries and hopefully for content in general. But there's always going to be a question about whether it makes more sense for them to invest in their own content or acquire finished content.
You haven't done a ton with Netflix. I know you're producing with Ava DuVernay a series about the Central Park Five. But you haven't done a ton with Netflix. Do you have a kind of attitude about the streamers in general and Netflix in particular?
We've done more on the narrative side with Netflix. So Roma, Beasts of No Nation, the Ava DuVernay series that you're talking about, which is actually a narrative version of the Central Park Five story.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
But we're having our first experience on the documentary side. But we've known the people over there for a long time. They're great. They're real, you know, original documentary people
for
who
sure.
understand the genre, and they're looking for quality too. So the streamers are our friends. The more distribution options there are for documentaries, the better it is for us as financiers of documentaries, and the better it is for the filmmakers, and the better it is for the audiences.
But you haven't cut any kind of deal. It seems like with every film, you're deciding what is going to be the best path for this film.
Right. I mean, we're platform agnostic when it comes to distribution. We're trying to find the best platform for that particular film in terms of both audience and impact.
So we've been talking a lot about American Factory, partially because it's a great example of what we've been talking about. When you go to Sundance and you try to sell a film, is it the biggest price? Is it what they promise in prints and advertising? Is it what are the, you know, the variables that go into deciding who is going to distribute the film?
When we go to Sundance or any other festival with a film that we're trying to sell to a distributor, we do our homework and we think about who the possible buyers are. But then we have to see who comes to the table and what they're offering. So it's a combination of, obviously, we're trying to be sustainable. We're trying to at least hopefully get the budget of the film back.
Right.
But we're also looking for the greatest reach and the greatest distribution, eyeballs, and impact.
Why did you go with Netflix to stream American Factory?
We had fantastic options for American Factory.
I bet you did.
We really did. And it was a very difficult choice because, you know, you hope to be in the position that we were in with American Factory, where we had honestly incredible options. And ultimately, the Netflix platform really did provide the biggest reach in terms of the potential audience. So that was really the decision, just reach and audience.
Can they promise you that it will be on the suggested for you or on the top of the front page? Or is that part of a deal you can make
no
with them?
No promises.
Really?
We didn't. There were no promises made about particular placement. Mm.
Foster is a film that's coming out. It's a very affecting film about kids and their experience in the foster care system. And HBO will be distributing that film. And HBO has just been sold to a big conglomerate, AT&T. And I wonder if that gives you pause, if you think how you think that's going to play out for HBO and documentaries, which has been such a, you know, respectable part of their business.
I don't really think I can speak for HBO.
But you, as a person who sells films to them, does
right.
that concern
I mean,
you?
For us, HBO is a perfect home for Foster.
Why?
Because they respect the filmmakers, they're respecting and allowing us to do the impact work around the film that happens off of HBO. It's a very collaborative relationship, and we have a longstanding relationship with HBO. I hope that HBO doesn't lessen its commitments to documentaries, because I'd say as much as Netflix is today, HBO has been a stalwart of documentaries and Sheila Nevins, and it's always been a place to find really high-quality film. So I think given how popular documentaries are right now, I can't see them moving away from it. But for our sake, I hope that it continues to be a really strong distribution option.
They spent 20 years making documentaries successful. It seems like they should be reaping the benefits of it now. So this is a big, broad question. What do you think the future of documentaries is as a genre, as an opportunity for social change, but also as a business?
I think the future of documentaries is awesome. And I've been in this business for a long time. And I was joking the other day that when I go through old notebooks from notes from films, I kept finding lists of other jobs I can do. I'd never felt like documentary filmmaking was a sustainable, viable, long-term career path. And I think that's really changed. It's never going to be easy. I mean, it's not documentary filmmaking and documentary financing and documentary distribution is not a get-rich-quick scheme. But it's incredible work. It's meaningful work. It's creatively fulfilling. And I really think that there's the market has matured for documentaries. I don't think that it's just a passing fad. So I'm very encouraged.
Well, Elise Perlstein is the Senior Vice President of Documentary at Participant Media. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts like the one that I host called The Document at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Matt Holzman. Kim Masters will be back next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.